Good evening. This is To the Point with Ed Mullins. I am retired Sergeant Pete Panuccio. I am sitting in for Ed. Tonight's guest is Mike Riley, New York State Assemblyman from Staten Island, former member of the service. So let's say hello to Mike. And Mike, tell us about yourself.
Hey, Pete. Thanks. Thanks for having me. Great to be on. I am, like you said, I'm currently a New York State member of the Assembly. I represent the 62nd Assembly District, which is the South Shore of Staten Island. Before entering into the Assembly, I got elected first in November of 2018, assumed office in January 1st of 2019. Before that, I was a member of the Community Education Council for District 31, which is the school board for Staten Island. I was an elected volunteer. I served in that capacity for 10 years. Each term was 2 years. And for the last four, I was the president of the council. Prior to that, I was a lieutenant in the 9-0 precinct before I got hurt in the line of duty and I retired. But, you know, some may ask me often, you know, did you see yourself doing this? I said, if you told me 15 years ago when I retired from the police department that I'd be a member of a school board, the school board president, and then a member of the state legislature, I would have told you were crazy. But you know what? It's that public service, community bond that I have that I just want to continue serving.
Now, you retired, what, 2005, 2006, around that part? Around
yeah, that period? Yep, 2006.
And you got locally involved.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. How it all started is I started volunteering at my kid's school. I did what's called the stop and drop program, where I would help the parents by taking their kids out of the car and making sure that they got into the school building safely, so that we can reduce the traffic around the school because the double and triple parking was out of control, and that's how it started. And I remember a funny story about it is the principal asked me about putting it together, and I did. I said, "Oh, I'll help out for about, you know, the first 2-3 weeks, get it off the ground." I have three kids and I wound up doing it for 10 years and every morning out there. But I used to have fun doing it. I dress up for all the for Halloween. I dress up for all the holidays in costumes. Many a time Santa Claus was directing traffic, filling in for crossing guard. So,
well, you know, I'm sure the people, your neighbors, your friends, the people that had their children attend, they appreciated that, knowing you. You have a New York City cop out there volunteering on his own time and making sure that everybody's kids are safe. It's often been said all politics are local, and that's usually where most people get their start. Now, so you started with the volunteering, and then what did you progress to after that?
Well, the volunteering at the school, and then somebody said that there was an opening on the school board. Why don't you you run for that office, which is a volunteer position as well? I said, sure. I said, well, you know, wherever I can do the best advocacy for our community. And, you know, that lasted for 10 years. I got reelected 5 times. And then the opportunity arose to run for the New York State Assembly representing my district. And, you know, at first, I had to talk to my family, my wife, who has rheumatoid arthritis and was severely sick for many years. And I had small children at the time when the first opportunity arose, and it wasn't the right fit for me. And then in 2018, when the opportunity arose, my wife was on to better health. My kids were older, and it seemed like a great opportunity, and my wife fully supported it, and she's been behind me ever since, actually leading from behind, because she's the real boss, right? And it's been one hell of a ride so far. In my second term.
That's outstanding. That really is outstanding. I've kind of ventured, made some inquiries about doing. I live in Manhattan now. I'm kind of up and down with the local party over here because they, where you have like a community in Staten Island where people will actually take an interest in their community, they'll work hard, they'll band together. that gets lost in the sauce in Manhattan. And you have a very progressive, very liberal community over here. I think people are getting quite disgusted with the conditions on the ground in Manhattan right now. It's getting pretty nasty. But I went back and forth with them a few times, and they're like, oh, yeah, we'll get back to you. You know, I'm a 39-year police veteran. The guy in the city council that runs my district, far left, and he just keeps pushing the usual nonsense, defund the police, bail reform, and like, hey, guy, do you take a look around you at what the neighborhood is turning into? And then you look me in the face and tell me everything's wonderful? It's not wonderful. Be that as it may. But anyway.
Pete, you know, you hit on a topic there, right there, where you said about your representative and most being out of touch with what's happening on the ground. You know, it's so funny you brought up bail reform and some other legislation. I remember debating bail reform. I took the lead on in our conference debating it. And that's one of the things that I try to instill to every member of the assembly when I'm speaking on the floor, not just the other side, but my side as well. I want everybody to realize that the words that we have on paper don't transition to the street the way they intend. And for many of the short side in this is they just don't listen to those that have the real life experience. I'll give you one example. We had a bill that was introduced that was going to allow the public to videotape police officers at any time, right? Just to codify that into law, which I'm not against. You know, people should be able to film in public. So one of the things that I did as I spoke to the sponsor of the bill, and I asked them point blank, listen, there's some issues here about public safety to the officer, safety to the citizens that are around, and safety even to the individual that's interacting with the police. Can we include a buffer zone in that law where it would prohibit filming within 20 feet, say, of an incident with a police officer? They flat out refused to include that in the legislation. So that just shows you that there's no real world experience. It's just an ideology that they have, and at the cost to our community and the safety of our police officers.
Just as a brief aside on that, I retired July 31st, 2020. August 1st, I started my first day of being a social justice warrior for police officers. I went out to a community gathering that was being held by two city councilmen, Justin Brannon and Brad Lander. And I used to torture these guys on Twitter. Unfortunately, my Twitter account, I've been permanently banned since about 3 weeks ago. But I used to put the wood to these guys because they're just delusional. And I went out there with a retired lieutenant, somebody we both know. And we showed up and waited till their little event was over. And I told Brandon who I was. And he was like, oh, wow, you're that guy from Twitter. I said, yeah, it's me. To his credit, we had an hour-long dialogue. But Brad Lander got into this conversation. And I have to tell you, I don't think I've ever met anybody that's as crazy as, and he's going to be the city controller. He's the guy. He's got the lead right now. This guy just goes off on a stream of consciousness about global warming. I don't know. You name it. He's got the issue. Everything except violence in New York City. Finally, I said, stop. That's it. Stop. You just talk 10 minutes without breathing in. Okay. Listen to me. I says, tonight, some kid in Bed-Stuy is going to get shot. Another kid's going to get shot up in Harlem. I says, some old man sitting in front of his building in Red Hook drinking a beer is going to get shot. I says, because you are the people that are causing this. And that was within the New York City purview, so to speak, with the compression bill, qualified immunity. And they just look at you, and Landa's like, well, I said, did you actually speak to anybody from the police department before you wrote this garbage? Well, they won't talk to us. He says, oh, they'll talk to you. I said, don't even give me that. All right, stop. I says, why don't you talk to retired guys like myself? And, you know, he looked at his watch and he says, I got to go. And off he went. And it's just, you know, we're at the point now, it's just complete insanity. Listen, before we get back to, I want to get back to bail reform in a second. Tell us about your child born on 9/11.
Oh, my son.
Yes.
Was my son, John, was born on September 10th, 2001. And, you know, I spoke recently about this at a remembrance at RUMSE, Richmond University Medical Center, here on the North Shore of Staten Island. And I got very emotional because it was like everyone, we have those emotions from that day. We remember those that we lost. But one thing that I shared, especially with the RUMSE staff who were in attendance and the overall community, was it was an experience that it was the most joyous time in my life. And then the very next day, it was deep sorrow. So my son was born on September 10th, and my wife and he were at RUMSE, which was then St. Vincent's Hospital. We lived in Brooklyn at the time. And I remember the night before, on September 10th night, at the night that night, I went out with a fellow sergeant of mine from the 6-7 precinct. We went out for a few drinks, and then we went home. And I got a call the very next morning, right away, from my oldest friend John Odlin, who was also a sergeant on the job. He was in the 4-2 squad. He called me up, and he's like, Mike, wake up. I hear the answer machine. I get it. I call him back. I turn on the news. And as we're watching the TV, we see the second plane hit. But John's first asking me and going, hey, did you see that replay? I go, John, that was no replay. I go, hang up. We got to call our command. And I called my command, and I called the 6-7, and lieutenant on the desk tells me, no, listen. I ask him, I go, where do you want me to report to? He goes, go to the hospital, see your son, see your wife, and call me when you get there. So the Verrazano Bridge was closed. Of course, I'm driving over the Verrazano with my sergeant shield out the window. And I get to RUMSE. I hold my son. I kiss my wife. And I call the command right away. I go, where do you need me? And they said, come in tonight because we're going to need relief. We're all going to be exhausted. So I came in for the midnight tour. I can't help but think that if it wasn't for my son being born the day before, I would have been there. I would have went straight from my house. I would have probably worked the 4 to 12 before the night before because I was on vacation since he was born the day before. And that sergeant, Billy Rawl, that I went out with the night before, he lost his brother and his brother-in-law. His brother was a firefighter. And his brother-in-law worked at Cantor Fitzgerald. So when I say that, you know, it went from being the most bittersweet moment when my son was born to absolute sorrow, I really mean that because it was just the up and down roller coaster. And then, you know, we lost my wife's cousin who was in Rescue 5, FDNY, Jeff Palazzo. And, you know, there's a picture that I shared on social media of my son wearing my police cap, and I'm in uniform, and back when the sergeants had white shirts. And that was a picture we took as we were going to a memorial for Jeff, probably less than 2 months after 9/11. And it's just, you know, like so many others, we have stories, we have the sorrow, we have the good memories, though, is I think what we really need to hold on to. The people who we got to know over time, over our lifehood, those lifelong friendships, and, you know, forever, we will remember them, and we have to pledge and continue never to forget.
Yeah, I, you know, the way I look at it, this was a very hard year for me. It was just, you know, a lot of stuff going on. I think with the buildup, with the collapse in Afghanistan, we're now back at a very dangerous point in this country because of that. But I think, you know, God sometimes has a plan, and he says, you know what? I think I'm going to do this on September 10th for Mike. And he had a plan for you. And, you know, there's joy in that, and that your son was born. And that was the plan. And that's one of the blessings. It really is. In such a tragic, horrendous situation. Well, thank you for sharing that. So let's move on a little bit with the current. Let's talk about the current insanity in Albany. It seems like we're surrounded insanity in New York, insanity in D.C., and then we have our own special brand of craziness called Albany. And, you know, my favorite governor, you know, Cuomo. I say that facetiously. What's going on in Albany? I'm at the point now, I need a scorecard to follow all the different things that are happening with Hochul, what's happening with Letitia James. Last night I did some reading before we come on about the Joint Commission on Public Ethics. And I'm absolutely mind-boggled. I don't see how this goes. The Joint Commission, I think in the last day, said, we're going to let Cuomo keep his $5.1 million. And they issued another ruling, and it had to do with some, you know, whether or not they had a proper quorum with Tisha James, is whether or not to revisit the issues with Joe Prococo, who is Cuomo's aide, but was also doing, I believe, 6 years in jail right now for some of the shenanigans. You start, because I don't know where to start. There's just a lot of different directions to go on this one.
You know, Pete, there's just so much to say about it, and there's so many moving parts. You know, the impeachment proceedings that were taken, you know, on Governor Cuomo with the Judicial Committee. Unfortunately, it didn't get a chance to really follow through and come to the full assembly for a vote. There's just so much evidence that the public doesn't have yet, that hopefully the report that comes out of the Judiciary Committee's findings will actually give us some more insight. You know, the thing that I think really spearheaded this was originally the nursing homes, and that's something that order by the governor with the nursing homes was really, I think, the tipping point. And that's where we finally got people to recognize that there was something wrong, something being hidden. And then, of course, everything else unraveled. And, in the Cuomo administration, the wheels just kept falling off the bus. And each time there was a different thing that hit and fell off. So there's just so much in there that the book deal, you know, we're finding out now, drips and drabs, that people that were in the administration were working on his book deal, which is strictly prohibited. So for you to say that they're going to allow him to, that report coming out, or insinuating that he will keep that money, it just doesn't, it really doesn't make sense. We know that people gave testimony from the administration saying that they worked on the book. So, you know, there's clearly many violations. And let's not forget, the reason why Andrew Cuomo resigned was because he was trying to save his legacy. He didn't want to be known as a governor that was impeached. I think there was just and let's not forget that this opens the door to possibly running for election again for office in New York State. So there's just so much there.
Yeah. You know, to me, he's like a vampire. You need like a Van Helsing to take that wooden stake and just bang through the heart and bury this guy once and for all. The horrible what happened with the nursing home situation, and now I believe the latest estimate is he undercounted by 50%. I'm sorry. Mistakes like that. Ooh, I forgot to add a zero. No, you didn't. That's not what happened. It's absolutely horrendous. You know, they segue then into the sexual harassment stuff. And he's a pig, man, just my opinion. He's a handsy, you know. In some respects, I understand. He's an all-the-time guy. Hey, oh, hey, how are you, honey? But we also know he's a pig. The Letitia James does her report. And as much as I dislike Cuomo and think he's, you know, he's a dirtbag, I had to say, is this right? Letitia James tried and convicted him in the court of public opinion with that report. Even a guy like Cuomo deserves his day in court. And I'm not saying that to defend him. I think if you catch my drift here. But the fact is, for whatever her political reason, she just dragged this guy through the mud. And did he really have a chance to respond? Or was it, I don't know. It didn't sit well with me because I think we've seen over the past couple of years politicians being tried in the court of public opinion. It's not right.
Well, Pete, you know, I mean, if you, I could touch on that from my perspective and just thinking about history, right? Think about what then Attorney General Cuomo did to Governor Spitzer. You know, there was always that
same thing,
that leap where, think about it, when they get that high up and they're looking to run for office, they have visions of grandeur that they want to be governor. They have political aspirations. I don't think that's any less true than what we saw in the past year, where there's a potential that Attorney General Tisch wants to run for governor. You think about how Governor Hochul now picked her lieutenant governor. If you don't think that that was politically motivated with her attempt to hopefully run for and her hopes of running for her own term as governor, then, you know, I think we're all fooling ourselves. So this is all, this is all political maneuvering. And could you, that, could, that okay.
No, no, finish, please.
No. So that's why I think the releasing of the report, you know, you think about it, if where else have you seen a top law enforcement officer, meaning a district attorney or an attorney general, do a whole investigation, entire investigation, and not conclude that there's a recommendation for prosecution when they deem that the facts that they have basically give probable cause or reasonable cause to believe, not presented to a grand jury? It just doesn't, it doesn't fit anything, any narrative except a political narrative.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny when you read, I started, did a bit of a deep dive into it last night with the recommendations and how it went with the stuff going on in Letitia James' office. It actually makes your head hurt. I think it's designed to confuse people, to not understand who's actually to blame, why it didn't go forward. There's a part of me that says, you know what? They're in damage control mode. They're in mitigation mode. Because I think if you look back on the history of Cuomo in Albany, you have the nursing homes, but you have the sexual harassment. And I think you have about a half dozen other major issues, like the stuff Joe Prococo was involved in. You had the issues going on up in Buffalo with the where a whole bunch of people got indicted. Hey, real quick, let me just ask you something. Tell us about our lieutenant governor.
Well, our lieutenant governor was a New York State senator who was picked by Governor Hochul to be her lieutenant governor. And, you know, from an historical aspect, remember the last time that we saw that a lieutenant governor was handpicked by a sitting governor? It was Governor Patterson after he was lieutenant governor and took over after Spitzer resigned. So that's why I think the Senator Benjamin, who is the now the lieutenant governor, I think that's why Governor Hochul picked him, because he is a New York City Democrat in the Senate, and he is been a proponent of defund the police. He is, I think, a political pawn in running in the governor's aspiration to run for her own term. You know, that's just me seeing it from the outside. I think that it's a calculated selection because I think she's trying to, she comes from upstate New York by the Buffalo area. And I think she's trying to secure support from downstate Democrats for her own election to her own term.
Yeah, he was also heavily involved in writing the bail reform bill. Am I correct on that?
I believe he played a significant role in the Senate version, which eventually was negotiated by both the Senate and Assembly majority conferences, which are the Democrats. So they actually put it out there, the legislation, and they pushed it. So, yeah, I would say that he played an integral role.
Yeah, like I said, I've often felt that when I looked at Hochul, she's been around for 7 years. If you asked 2 weeks ago, whenever he resigned, if you asked anybody who Kathy Hochul was, they go, who? You know, it would be like, name the vice president of the United States in 1923, all right? You'd have a better chance of figuring out who that is as who the lieutenant governor was of New York State. So now she's been thrust into this position, and it just seems, yeah, she has her aspirations. But I also, like I said, I think they want to mitigate some of the stuff that still could come out with Cuomo. To me, he's a sociopath. He's not accepting. Will he accept blame? I guess that's not exactly the word I want to use. But as far as he's concerned, you know, he has no empathy for other human beings. Just look at the wreckage he caused with, you know, with the nursing homes. And he's one of those guys like Bill de Blasio. Bill de Blasio is one of the most despised people in the country. Yet he ran for president of the United States. And I mean, with everybody yelling at him and saying, yeah, I'm going to run for president.
Well, let's not forget, he's also thinking about supposedly running for governor.
Oh, please, yeah. Please. You know, it's I don't understand how people move ahead in political life like that. But when you look at their accomplishments, if you look at, as I always equated, the old Mr. Magoo cartoon, when it opens, Mr. Magoo's driving down the street and there's a trail of wreckage behind him. That's de Blasio, who in my own opinion, just my opinion, has his own issues with corruption and things that went on in his administration. But getting back to Albany, it is just really hard these days to keep track of the players, what's going on. Hello. Oh, here I am. I'm back. What do you see as the path forward here? Do we see any kind of redemption, any kind of sanity coming back into the state legislature?
You know, that's a good question. And for next November, not this November coming, but November in 2022, we have some significant elections, right? We have election for governor, and all the state Senate and state assembly seats are up. That's where we can really make some changes to the state legislature and the executive. You know, right now there's such an imbalance because it's one party rule, and one party rule in Albany, we're seeing the results. You described them earlier on the streets of Manhattan. I describe them in the streets in Staten Island. There's just so much disconnection by our state representatives because of one party rule, that they are hurting our communities. You look at bail reform. You know, one thing that I couldn't help but think about was when they first rolled out bail reform and it passed after we tried to warn them. We tried to say that it wasn't going to be as rainbows like you think it's going to be and unicorns, right? They think about when judges were first, there was many articles about it, where judges were letting people go because they just didn't understand how the legislation should have been transitioned. You had one judge, if I'm not mistaken, in an article said, my hands are tied. I have to let him out. And this is a person who assaulted several people over a 2-week time period.
One of the first guys that got collared was a career criminal. He had about 75, 80 collars. I don't recall. I think it might have been burglary. I'm not 100% sure what the crime was now. He was one of the first. And the first thing he did, he got out, he says, thank you, Governor Cuomo. You know, and we look at this. In the last couple of months before I retired, we had guys that were on burglary rampages in the West Village. They grabbed this guy one night. We got him for 16. Okay, bing, collared, and the next night, literally 24 hours later, the lieutenant from the 6th Precinct calls me up, and he's like, you know that guy we grabbed the other day? I says, yeah. He said, can you double check and see if he's in? And I look, and I said, he's out. 16 burks out the next day. We're seeing time and time again, the gun violence within the city now is becoming epidemic. I think we know that. But you have guys that are getting caught with handguns, they're getting cut loose in arraignment. When you talk about these local elections, and George Soros has pumped millions into local races around the nation, as we see in San Francisco, Portland, Seattle. He's pumping money into Alvin Bragg, who's got the Democratic nomination for New York County DA. And this guy's a knucklehead. I mean, he's an experienced guy, but he's putting the progressive line out there. He will not prosecute for thefts under $250. He threw another one out a few weeks ago that they're not going to prosecute for carrying a handgun unless the gun was actually used. What is wrong with you people?
Pete, it's funny that I say funny that we're discussing it, and not funny at all about the issue. Give you one example of my fight in Albany with the insanity. They introduced legislation about 3D firearms, and 3D firearms can be a real threat. And when you think about 3D firearms, right, they're not as freely accessible to people. So if you have someone with a 3D firearm, they probably have it for a nexus to something really, really severe, whether that's, terrorism, whether that's a hired hitman, something to that effect, right? So I raised those issues on debate about it. And the reason why I did that is because the legislation they were introducing was going to make the possession of a 3D firearm an e-felony. Now, why do I raise that point about it being a problem, being an e-felony? Well, e-felonies, you can get a desk appearance ticket. So you have to let them go within a few hours, right? So my issue with that was on debate, I raised and said, so now you're hindering the potential investigation because we're going to notify JTTF, right? Joint Terrorism Task Force. We're going to have the squad enhance it. We're going to have people talk to the person who had the firearm and see if we can get more details about it. But being that you're mandating that a person get a desk appearance ticket if they're arrested for an e-felony, you have to let them out within 2 hours. That's the problem. The reason why I raised that issue with the 3D firearm being an e-felony, think about under the penal law, if you have a defaced firearm with a serial number, that's a d-felony. So they're comparable, and I don't understand why they want to pretend that they're being woke about criminal justice, and they're really not.
Real quick, Mike, just for our audience, explain a 3D firearm, what it is.
So a 3D firearm is one that's created with a 3D printer, right, which is a very expensive piece of equipment. And what they do is they replicate what a firearm would be. They create all these pieces that would be put together as a firearm. And that's, the 3D aspect of it is it's untraceable. And it's the material they're using could be undetectable. So that's one of the that's probably one of the scariest items that you can come across, I think, when you're thinking in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, there was I remember when that was they were talking about it. There was a lot of hype in the media about 3D firearms. I've seen exactly zero. Okay, yeah, because it too. Is a very to manufacture that firearm, you need some pretty sophisticated machinery. You have to know what you were doing. Are they out there? I'm sure they're out there. You know, I don't doubt that at all. Actual percentage of the amount of firearms that are floating around, I'd say put about 6 zeros and then a 1. But now, you know, as they carry on about the danger of these weapons, you make it a Class E felony. Okay. Now, right now, certain Robs, these guys are getting desk appearance tickets at the station house. So you go out and punch somebody in the face, steal their handbag, you're eligible for a desk appearance ticket. You go do a Berg, you're eligible for a desk. I mean, this is complete insanity, what they're doing. Because you're letting the guys that are predicates, the guys that are hardcore criminals, they're loving this. Absolutely loving this.
They're empowering them.
They're making it unsafe for us, and they're empowering the bad guys.
So we have we have my conference, the Republican Assembly Conference. We actually introduced a package of legislation to improve the criminal justice system and public safety. One of the bills that I introduced actually would allow judges to have judicial discretion when it comes to setting bail, and I also the legislation that I introduced. Would add more crimes that are bailable offenses, meaning that bail could be set, and also the discovery issue with the district attorneys and the prosecutors. It would give them more time to be able to gather the evidence they need. Because right now, think about it, if they don't hit that discovery point by a certain time, for technical issues, crimes would be dismissed.
Real quick, Mike, explain you brought up a great point here. I'm friends with a lot of prosecutors, and prosecutors were quitting in droves because they couldn't deal with the discovery issue. Please explain to our viewers what's going on with discovery.
That was part of bail reform. The district attorneys throughout the state, the prosecutors, are required to submit information to the defense counsel within 45 days at the time. And you think about it, in all the crime, in all the investigations that we know take place as members of law enforcement, 45 days isn't that long of a time period. No. And there are many times where we come across things that are pertinent to investigations months afterwards. Especially during long-term investigations. And what this is doing, what that law was doing, it was now providing the opportunity for cases to be dismissed. Another aspect of discovery that was really troubling is the fact that those who are charged with really heinous crimes, maybe a burglary that entailed a rape, that defendant and the defense attorney must be allowed into that crime scene. So if it happened at a person, a family's residence, you're now opening your home. You're getting hurt again because you know that that person who damaged you, who made you a victim and made you feel so vulnerable, could be allowed back into your house so they can get information about, the diagram of the house, just for their defense purposes. I think that was short-sighted, and we raised the issue several times, and it's something that I think is really concerning.
You know, I'm rather evil at times. And I'm kind of like, you know what? Yeah, you want to come in my house? Sure, counselor. Come on in. I says, I got room for both of you in the backyard. It's insane that a victim should be victimized originally, the original crime, and now you got this mutt and his lawyer standing in your living room. I'm sorry. it's not happening. You're not coming to my house. End of story. And, you know, it'll subsequently lead to another incident, of course, with the police. But in that particular situation, this is stuff that was built into these cases, built into this law, basically to collapse all these prosecutions, to make them fail. There's no way. I was the local DA here in Manhattan. They had to hire a whole staff of people just to deal with the discovery material. And I'm you know what? I'm out over a year now. There's probably still emails going to me on from different, you know, oh, do you have your memo book entry for this day?
Yeah.
This day, I don't even know what year it is, you know, because they're asking about old cases and stuff. And it seems like that was it. That was the poison pill inserted into each case to kill it. It's just not good practice. It's not good law. And we're seeing the results around us. You're a gentleman. I don't think I could sit in Albany and say and not be screaming, "What is wrong with you people?" I don't know.
I do find myself screaming, loud on the floor, but it's very disheartening, and sometimes it's crushing, right? But I can't give up the fight. I have to keep raising the issues. I have to keep trying to get them to see their errors. And, you know, one of the things with bail reform, let's not forget that it was really spearheaded because of the Kalief Broward case. And it is a really horrendous circumstance of facts that led to Kalief committing suicide. But, you know, I understand the need for reform. You know, listen, I don't think there's anybody that's involved in a criminal justice system that doesn't say that there's some way that we can improve things. The problem is that they took one circumstance and tried to fix the whole system by having a one size fits all process. And, you know, let's not forget that the original case with Kalief Broward was actually a Rob II acting in concert with another.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say that it was just a petty larceny, basically, but it was really a Rob II. And what happened is, like, they're now saying that Rob II, because it's not defined as a violent felony under the penal law, that it's not really a violent crime. Let's remember that, you know, street robberies can turn deadly in a heartbeat. You know, just the mere fact that you have two or more people surrounding somebody, asking them for their property, is a robbery. The force is there, whether it's implied or actually used. And that's one of the scenarios that I tried to explain to them, and, you know, showing them that these words on the street will not, these words on paper will not transition to the street the way they should.
No, and absolutely not. And there were also a lot of other issues, like same way Michael Brown started in the beginning with the whole, with the Black Lives Matter stuff, you know, hands up, don't shoot. All right, he was beating the hell out of a cop and trying to take the cop's gun when he got shot. Mind you, this is after he did a strong arm robbery in the store prior to running into the cop, and a whole narrative built up around him that was false, garbage. So you got Kalief. Kalief wasn't not a great kid to begin with, all right? I don't mean this to disparage him in any way, but the fact was he was already doing some bad stuff. When he wound up in the system, we've had some corrections officers on here. You know, this is a kid that was constantly assaulting the guards, assaulting other inmates. That's why he went into punitive segregation. Did he fall through the cracks? Yeah, in a lot of ways he did. The kid shouldn't have been sitting in Rikers for 2 years over that particular case. But as you said, let's apply this solution so it encompasses everything. It doesn't work. You know, there are people that are getting cut loose that are out on the streets now that should not be on the streets. I'm glad you brought up the Broward case. Where do you think they're going? What is their end game in this? I mean, sometimes I have to sit back and say, do they honestly believe their own nonsense? I mean, or are they pandering to get votes? Or do they really think at some point this whole progressive, like it's somehow going to work out in the end? Where do you think they're going at the end here?
You know, I wish I was able to give that answer. And, you know, the great Kreskin, you know, I wish I could tell you, but I can't help.
You're dating
but
think, yourself there. Yeah, pal. Yeah.
I can't help but think about they think they're going to get to this utopia. And, you know, some of them are really believe it, you know, true believers and think that this is the right path. But many of them, I think it's they're succumbing to political process. They know that they're pandering and they're trying to get more votes, you know, because they all have this political aspiration, maybe what they want to do. I just wish they would really talk to the experts. And like I said, it's not just talking to law enforcement and talking to district attorneys. We talk to those community-based organizations as well. You know, that we can come to a compromise. It's a matter of actually listening and not painting everybody with a broad brush. And, you know, we have a lot of work to do. And that's something that I think we just can't stop trying.
Now, let me just, how much support do legislature members like yourself, how much support is there for you within the legislature? Like how many people like vote for sanity? I mean, is it right now you said it's one party. What are the percentages up there right now?
So let me tell you how the Senate and the Assembly are broken down. Right now, there are 150 members of the state assembly. There are 107 members that are Democrats and 43 members that are Republican. In the Senate, there are 63 senators, 43 are Democrat, and 20 are Republican. And we also have in the executive, we have a Democrat. So that's what one party rule is. And you see that they can't even get along with themselves. They have many disputes.
I know.
You know, and you know, that's where I think the balance of power in Albany really needs to change. And I'm not necessarily saying that one party rule on the Republican side would be tremendous as well, right? No way. I think when you have everybody in the same room that actually thinks the same way, we don't really fix things, right? I think a balance of power is really how we could make the necessary changes. And we get a little rational thinking. Right now, it's irrational. And there's just so much being jammed down our throats that I think the people in New York State and New York City are going to wake up.
At some point, I mean, you know, we say, how do we turn this around? And to which I always say, people need to get involved. The last two mayoral elections in New York City were basically, I mean, it was the smallest turnouts ever. And they're driven by these small, hypercharged groups. Hence, you get a guy that ran on bashing cops and de Blasio. A few hundred thousand votes in New York City swings the election. Probably not even that many. I think you look at Staten Island, swung it for Rudy Giuliani in 93. And you have, it seems like a lot of people that aren't even bothered anymore to get up and vote or take interest in what's going on.
The apathy is just amazing. It really is.
And what happens is you get guys, like I said, Alvin Bragg, complete boob, running for Manhattan DA. He's running against a guy, Tom Kniff, Army major, reservist in JAG, did a couple of combat tours. Common sense and pragmatic. Understands that there's changes that need to be made in the system. We get it. But you also have to put public safety first. And it's such an uphill battle trying to get support and get the word out. And you look around, like Philadelphia, what happens? You got a guy like Larry Krasner, who's the DA down there. Homicide rate through the roof. You know, it just, it's insane, but it's because people are not getting involved. And it can be as little as the pandemic kind of screwed things up, where we weren't having public meetings the way we used to, town halls and stuff like that. I'm retired now. I no longer care. I'll go to these meetings. I'll yell. I'll scream. I'll make a scene. It seems to me, until you embarrass, I'm not saying you get physical or anything like that, but they need to be embarrassed. They need to be questioned. They need to be questioned publicly and say, hey, what are you doing here? And you got to be ready to counter them with the facts and say, no, that's a lie. And because people are just, it is apathy. And you know what? What happens? This is what we have now. Do you think we, I mean, is something, I don't even want to say something drastic, because every day we read another horror story. Brian Watkins was killed in 1991 in front of his family going to the tennis open. It was a watershed event for Dinkins at the time. I worked on the case, and it was a horror show, and that ran in the media for weeks. It seems today we have stories that are just as horrible, but because it's social media and a 24-hour news cycle, these things are there and they're gone, and you move on to the next horror show. I don't think people can be even be shocked anymore. It seems like we're getting numb to the violence and what's going, numb to the corruption. How do we turn this around? I mean,
it's, Pete, you said it at the beginning when you're saying you need to go, people need to get involved and go to the meetings and talk to their elected officials and, you know, face to face, show up at the meetings when they can. Now it's Zoom and all the electronic meetings. More people can attend, but we're not seeing it, right? I think that the involvement and showing the concern, even at the community board levels, that's where you start to get change. And, you know, until we have that passion from our community members really taking the fight to the meeting and taking the fight to our elected officials, we're not going to see any of that change. You think about, put it into this perspective. When the protests were happening that gave change to legislation that was introduced, unfortunately, at times it became a riot, right? There were 4,000 people that were involved in that, roughly, right? That was the approximation of the crowd. So the people who were making the loudest noise were only a fraction, a decimal of what the New York City public and the public throughout the country. But that's who legislators listened to. That's where they were woke, and they introduced legislation that would actually potentially hurt our communities. And they weren't even thinking about it. They were just worried about those 4,000 people approximately that were making the most noise. And until residents of New York State and residents of New York City actually raise their voice and want changes, we can't get the majorities to do it. And that's really, it's empowering yourselves. You have to empower yourselves as a community to get what you want. And, you know, and that means dedicating your time and your effort, because that's what really is needed. I carry that torch every day when I'm in the legislature. I try and listen to all my constituents and raise their concerns. Far too often, our legislators aren't listening to their constituents.
You have a solid community where you're at in Staten Island, and people that want their community to be safe. They want their children. Like you come over to the other island here, Manhattan Island, and it's a different show altogether. I'm living in my building a long time. So people know me. They know what I did for a living. And they ask me, and I'm like, what do you expect? All right. If you keep voting for the same nonsense, because I always voted this way, or because, it doesn't work anymore. So don't complain.
The definition of insanity, right? The definition of insanity. Keep doing the same thing over and over again, thinking you're going to get the different result.
You know, there's a big part of me that sometimes I say I've had enough. I'm a city kid, born and raised in the streets here. Part of me loves New York City, 39 years as a cop. And there's another part of me that just wants to run away, move up to the top of the Adirondacks and just hide in a log cabin. I just can't take it some days. But on that note, I need to ask you a question. I was reading your material yesterday about actually separating Staten Island from New York City. Is that a feasible proposition? Is it, explain to me how that would work.
So a colleague of mine, David DiPietro, assembly member from upstate, he introduced legislation to break New York State into regions, basically. And it would be their own, it would try and give local authority to those regions a little greater than we have today. Part of the legislation breaks down Long Island and like Rockland County, Orange County into the same district, upstate further north country into their own. And Staten Island part that would be part of the New York City area. And the New York City region would be that third region. I was hoping to include Staten Island in the North Country region, only because I think we align with their beliefs and the way we want our government ran with that. The concept is a good venture. Do I think the governor and the legislature is going to let it move? Absolutely not. I don't think they'll even entertain it. But I think it legislation like that opens up the opportunity to have a discussion, and it opens up people to a different view of how each region is treated, how different governments act in their communities, how different laws apply in different aspects of the state. And, you know, that's something that I think we're all in silos, and we miss out on best practices for our communities. And, you know, the overall one size fits all just isn't working. And you can't treat each part of the state the same when we all have different needs.
100% correct.
You know, you think about the New York State Assembly is really controlled by New York City Democrats. They have the most seats. And why is that? Because we break it down to approximately 130,000 residents for each assembly district. And just by sheer number wise, New York City represents half the population of New York State. That's why you're going to get so many seats in the assembly. Now, this is a very important thing. Today, we have the redistricting maps being released today, which is every 10 years after the census. They redraw the state Senate lines and the state assembly district lines, and also the congressional districts. So those first maps are going to be introduced today. And that's by the Independent Redistricting Commission. What's going to happen now is there's going to be some public hearings so people can talk about and raise issues and give input on those proposed districts. Now, these aren't the final maps that are going to be released. These are just the initial ones. After this process is done, and it has to be accepted by the state legislature next year before the primaries start in 2022. So this is a very important day where we'll get a first look at these districts and the proposed districts. And what does that mean? That means who can represent you in that district, because the person in the assembly and in the Senate have to live in the district. And, you know, it breaks down how many Republicans, how many Democrats, how many independents are in those districts. And that's why it's supposed to be an independent review. It's to keep politics out of it. But let's remember, this is state, this is the New York State Legislature and the governor's office. There's always politics involved.
Yeah. Oh, I imagine it's going to break out into open warfare and screaming tonight on the 6 o'clock news. People are going to be yelling. Somebody's going to get their nose out of joint on that one. Yeah, I was always curious because I know over the decades I've heard a Staten Island separatist movement going on. And then I was reading some of the stuff about what you were saying, it with how they break up the state. I don't live on Staten Island. I got to be honest with you. If I was a Staten Island resident, you know what? Yeah, we'll go our own way. Because it seems like the rest of New York City is determined to sink itself. So, Mike, I want to thank you for spending the time with us today and educating our listeners. Do you have to worry about your map today? Are you good?
I don't know. I think we'll see. I mean, I'm waiting to look at it. And, you know, we all have to worry about each map, I think. And the reason why I say that is that's basically who's going to represent you and all of New York State in the legislature. So regardless of where you live, I think all these maps matter. And that's really what it comes down to. It's how do you see your state moving in the future?
Yeah. And you know what? We've mentioned this theme several times now. People need to get involved. Even if it's going to your school board meetings, community board meetings, you need to get involved. You need to make noise.
It's like you said, Pete, it's like you said earlier, how you started this off. Politics, all politics is local.
Yeah, and you know what, Mike? I think there's actually a lot of middle ground, and I think there's a lot of support for sanity in the city and in the state. We just need to get people educated and get them out there. So I want to thank you, sir.
No, thank you.
Best of luck with whatever you have coming up. I will be following you, your developments in Albany. I would say probably at some point in the next few months, we'll probably be back on here together because I'm sure the Cuomo saga is far from over, what's going on with that crew. But thank you again, Mike.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks for having me.
I'm Pete Pannuccio. I'm filling in for Ed Mullins this week on To The Point. All you people out there, go to the SBA channel, Sergeants Benevolent Association on YouTube. Click like, click subscribe, and watch some of the older stuff on there. It's pretty good. So, everybody, thank you, and have a great day.
Thanks, Pete.